Hi, I'm Lisa Davis. Welcome back to It's Your Health. Do you remember being a child and having boundless curiosity about the world? Or do you have children in your life and you often see the light of curiosity in their eyes? Do you still have it? If not, would you like to get it back? Are you curious about how to get it back? Well, joining us today is Todd Cashin, PhD, author of the new book, Curious, Discover the Missing Ingredient to a Fulfilling Life. Dr. Cashin has published over 80 original publications in peer-reviewed journals, or edited volumes that mostly focus on anxiety disorder, self-regulation, positive emotions, how personal strengths operate in everyday life, interpersonal relationships, and the assessment and cultivation of well-being, curiosity, gratitude, and meaning and purpose in life. His research has been funded by grants from the National Institute of Health, Veterans Integrated Service Network, Anxiety Disorder Association of America, Society for a Science of Clinical Psychology, and the Positive Psychology Network. He has been active in the positive psychology movement since 2000 when he taught one of the first college courses on the science of happiness. He is an associate editor of the Journal of Positive Psychology and on the editorial boards of the Journal of Anxiety Disorders, Behavior Therapy, Journal of Social and Clinical Psychology, Journal of Research and Personality, and Self and Identity. He is on the advisory board for the Center for Applied Positive Psychology in the United Kingdom. Dr. Cashin, I want to welcome you to It's Your Health.
Thank you very much. I realize that I need more hobbies after hearing how many things you have to say
you
about.
You know what? I still have more to read, but I'm thinking, you know, I think we'll get to that because if I read all the amazing things you've done, our time will be up. Seriously, you've done some amazing work. Now, if you can tell us about what happened in your life when you were young that kickstarted your quest for meaning and brought you to where we are today, where you are.
Sure. You know, for me, it's a little bit of a tragic story, but it's a long time ago. Is I lost my mother when I was 13 years old to breast cancer, what I realized very quickly was if life was a game of tag, I didn't have a base to really return to, didn't have a safe haven, and I had a mixture of a lot of emotions that people typically experience at the same time, which is a little bit anxious, a little bit self-conscious, and a little bit intrigued about how to navigate the complexities of figuring out who I am and try and figure out the social hierarchy of who I'm going to sit with at lunchtime during middle school and high school. And this made me realize the importance of trying to understand the value of these blended emotional experiences, and sometimes the anxious and challenging events in our lives are really springboards, testing grounds for what strengths we have, discover what strengths we have, and they offer opportunities. These moments of uncertainty are possibly some of the most profound areas where we can grow as a person. And the research that I've done over the years has borne that out, and we see that when we put people in the brain scanners, is when they have uncertain events that are very meaningful to them, the positive experiences are more profound and they last longer.
Really?
In terms of our mindset.
Oh, that's so interesting. You know, in the beginning of the book, you know, you're talking about the search for happiness, which I mentioned in the introduction that you taught a class on, the science of happiness, and that's missing. What's missing from so many books is curiosity. And why do you think this has been overlooked by what you write about as, quote, a multi-billion-dollar self-improvement industry with a staggering number of books, tapes, motivational speakers, therapists, and gurus? Where is curiosity in all of this?
I think there's two things. One is it's hard to compete with happiness. And people get really excited and, excuse me, people, when you ask people in surveys of tens of thousands of people, they ask for what's their ultimate objective in life. Most people describe it as happiness. And I think the layperson uses it to describe all the positive things in their lives. And one of the things that I talk about when I give workshops is we need a precise language to describe the positive in ourselves and other people to really break down what happiness means. Because if we're talking about finding meaning in life, if we're talking about wisdom, if we're talking about a mindful interaction with a romantic partner where we're completely attentive to everything they're saying, obliterating all our ideas of who they are and how we typically label them, and we put all this under happiness, we can't actually intervene to make these moments more frequent in our lives because it's hard to move this very globular block called happiness. And the thing about curiosity is I think everyone understands what it feels like to be curious.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if I walk down the street and I see a 14-year-old kid wearing a Barry Manilow t-shirt, you don't have to tell me to be curious.
That's
I'm wondering,
true.
How bullied is that kid in terms of... How did they end up becoming a Barry Manilow fan?
That's right. about 30 years too late.
And so I think there's an overestimation of how much we know about a lot of these strengths, such as gratitude and curiosity and kindness, because we feel as if we already have our hands around it. And just as if we all know that we should be working out 30 minutes a day at least 3 times a week, and we all know that we shouldn't be eating cheese doodles at 3 o'clock in the morning when we're watching a Martin Scorsese film, it's a difference between knowing what to do and doing it. And there's a lot of complexities about curiosity that can help us better understand ourselves and how to wield this strength like a laser.
Yeah, now, what are some of these complexities of curiosity?
Well, one of them, for example, is the idea of it's not just a lust for new experiences, the bizarre, the mysterious, and the obscure. You know, if I go to a trip to Africa and I'm in Togo and a hippo is running after me, we've got ourselves a very novel, very interesting, very intriguing event. A hippopotamus is chasing me down the street. So now, for some people on the street in Togo who are residents there, they might be laughing and find this to be a very intriguing, interesting experience. Mm-hmm. I, on the other hand, being chased by the hippo, am not curious in the slightest.
No, you just want to get the heck out of there.
Right. So there's this very tricky question, which is, how do we deal with the fact that a lot of novelty and uncertainty is actually painful and aversive? And one thing that comes from that is, it's not just recognizing novelty in our natural life. It's not just being tolerant of uncertainty. It's also about the belief that we can handle and deal with that novelty uncertainty. And so if I go to Spain and I'm in the local museums and looking at surrealistic art, if I'm not very knowledgeable about art and I'm looking at this and there's no title, it's very easy for me to quickly recognize this is interesting and novel, but I can't understand it, so I'm going to move on to the next picture. And if I believe that I can potentially comprehend and get a foothold or a handhold into this bizarre painting that's sitting in front of me, then I'm going to explore. I'm going to spend more time viewing it. I'm going to be looking at the paint strokes. I'm going to be trying to figure out what the author was trying to say. And so this is one of the reasons why in a lot of museums they really focus on art that has titled work, because it gives an entry point into the mind of the artist for those people that are really low in terms of their ability to understand art.
I see. But in the book, you talk about the importance of, I guess, is it embracing uncertainty or seeing it as a positive thing that can make your life more intriguing?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, one of the things of in terms of relationships, when we look at people for 10, 20 years of what predicts relationship satisfaction, passion, after being with the same partner, the same naked body next to you for decades on end. And a lot of us are going to live longer, so we might be seeing the same naked person for 80 years of our lives.
That's a long time.
That's, I know, it's scary. I'm thinking about if I should be married right now.
I was about to say, I love you, honey, but that's a long time.
I know, exactly. Is the number one predictor of relationship satisfaction is boredom.
Yeah.
It's because and here's one of the mantras in the book, is as soon as we think we're an expert at something, we stop paying attention.
Oh, okay.
And this is one of the things that leads to decline in relationships, is I might have a very interesting conversation with a colleague at work where, you know, they tell me a story of how they went, they're into triathlons, and they found, you know, they learned how to swim, took an adult swim class, and I'm driving home and already filtering of whether my wife is going to be interested in the story before I even get home. And I might not even tell her the story because I'm already predicting, that's not something she's interested in.
Yep. Yeah.
And we do this all the time. They tell us, our partner tells us a story, they're telling what happened at their work or with their friends, and we already start putting it into the little category in our brain that says the conversations and interactions with that friend of theirs is always boring, and you start tuning out instead of really paying attention and being open to what's happening in the moment.
Yeah.
And obliterating those categories, those labels, these tendencies we have to try and make sense of things so quickly that we actually turn off the process that allows us to grow and expand in terms of understanding our partner and growing inside this relationship.
Yeah, you know, you also, I love in the book how you talked about, you know, it's important too with your partner, you know, if you're doing the same things all the time, you know, even if you're relaxing together, it's more important to do different things to keep that curiosity alive and to keep the interest alive too. Because people get in a, you know, you can get in a rut.
Right, and I think these are conversations that a lot of people don't have with their partner, which is two people sitting down when the kids are asleep, if you have kids, if not, just pop on the couch or the back porch and just say, you know, I'm feeling a little bit bored and a little bit malaise in my life. What do you feel? And do you want to add something different? This is just, you know, this is a really important relationship maintenance skill that what I hope is from reading this book, very simple techniques to start to enhance and add some energy, some vitality, and some passion into people's lives.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's why I'm so glad you're on the show, and I highly recommend the book because it really does. And even just, you know, aside from relationships, just finding the interest and the excitement in the mundane that you talk about, like going to a grocery store and actually really looking at the different things rather than just walking down the aisle to get what you want, just sort of seeing the colors and, it, you know, engaging with people. I think that's really important, too.
And I think having given talks around the world on these topics, is the typical reaction is, I already know these things.
Yeah, I've seen a serial. What's more, more
right? So basically, what you're just telling me is to look for novelty, and you know, the devil's in the details. And you know, some of the most interesting research that's being done is taking people that have ruled out an activity ahead of time without ever trying it, because they've heard from word of mouth that it's boring. And so we take women that have no interest in football, we take men that have no interest in quilting, we take college students that have never listened to classical music before, and what we ask them to do is engage in this activity with one goal, not to be to feel good, no, we don't care whether you like it or not, just look for three things that are really interesting and novel compared to what you typically do. And what you find is when people are looking for something interesting, something off the cuff, so rap music, which I can't stand. If you listen to them, a lot of times they take very bizarre sounds from the natural environment and shove it into the music. And trying to discover what those sounds are makes it a little bit more engaging, a little bit more energizing.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen people use blow dryers, cracking light bulbs against a wall, fans. You know, these are used as musical instruments in a lot of rap songs. And what you find is when people look for something interesting, they end up becoming more intrigued, and when they're asked 2 weeks later, did you do that activity again, they're much more likely to say yes. Is whatever we intend to look for, we end up finding. And if we assume ahead of time, rule things out, or rule people in our lives of saying, this is boring, this is painful, this is not part of something that would be relevant to my life, we are basically unintentionally removing some of the sandbox that we can play in with our life. And there are simple strategies that people can use to add to their playground for their livelihood.
Yeah, you know, and the book talks a lot about those. If you can just mention a couple, what your strategies are to get started for people who are still feeling a little stuck.
Sure. You know, one thing is when we talk about mindfulness, you're talking about curiosity.
Okay.
And so mindfulness is about paying attention with flexibility, openness, curiosity. And one of the strategies is to simply choose an activity each day. It could be dinner time with your family. It could be settling into work in the morning before you get started. It could be, if you're a student, the 5 minutes before class when you're just kind of gathering your books together, saying hello to people that are sitting next to you before class starts. Just pick a small activity. It could be you're running on the treadmill at the gym and purposely looking for what's distinct about this moment compared to any other time that you've done it. Paying attention to how your mood, how your thoughts are changing from one moment to the next. And what you're doing is you're observing. It's the observing self versus the thinking self. The thinking self we're too familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
We're always second-guessing ourselves. We're always recognizing, I'm anxious, so clearly this is not something that I like doing. I'm so tired as I'm working out right now. I probably had a good enough workout. The other person appears not to be making eye contact with me as we're talking. Clearly they don't like me. This is the thinking self. The observing self is recognizing these thoughts, these feelings, what's happening, but not getting tangled up with them, not assuming that what our mind tells us is really the truth. If that was, you know, if everything our mind told us was the truth, we would be, all of us would be perverted sociopaths, because we have these thoughts that crawl through our brain all the time of, I'll be in the middle of a meeting at work and thinking to myself, I wonder what would happen if I yelled, just stood up and said, I love gerbils.
Oh my God.
So these thoughts will pop through your head.
Great. Yeah.
And you know, and what happens is that because you think it doesn't mean that that's necessarily what you're going to do. We can listen to it, observe it, and just say, thank our mind for having this interesting thought. Recognize what's really happening. I'm having the thought that I want to stand up and talk about how much I love gerbils. And so just this little distancing ourselves from that, having these negative thoughts, having anxious feelings, yeah, having thoughts that someone might be boring us, is we can listen, but we don't have to pay attention and follow suit as if our brain is the overlord and everything it says is something that's who we are as a person and a true representation of what reality is.
I see. You know, speaking of anxiety, you can use curiosity to help control anxiety. And if you can, you know, talk about that, because I know you've done a lot on anxiety research, and there's a lot of anxiety on both sides of my family, and my child included. So I'm really interested, and I know a lot of parents out there that are listening also have this issue too.
Right. So the modal treatment for dealing with anxiety, and when I say treatment, I'm not talking about people with disorders, because every one of us experiences some degree of anxiety.
Okay.
Is basically the goal is to try and get rid of these anxious thoughts and feelings through some sort of strategy. Usually it's through exposure, which is repeatedly over time exposing people to small things that are dangerous or threatening to the person, and then moving up a hierarchy to things that are the real major things that bother people. So if you're afraid of... So I worked with a client that was afraid of butterflies. And the first thing we would do is watch movies of butterflies. We'd look at books of butterflies. We had a jar with a butterfly in it that was 75 feet away from him. And so you just look at it. And how we deal with this is we can take a curious mindset, which is... When I had this child that I was working with that was afraid of butterflies, which, by the way, it's a bizarre phobia.
Yeah.
They're butterflies.
Yeah, usually people think, oh, they're so pretty. I see, you know, spiders or bees. I'm majorly afraid of bees, so
right.
I need to work with you.
Dogs that fondle the mouth like Cujo with pancake syrup hanging off their face. Butterflies tends to be a little bit unusual.
Yeah, but that's okay.
Yep, so what we had was we had a jar with a butterfly in it. 75 feet away, he was flattened like a pancake against the other wall of the room, terrified of the fact that the butterfly is going to break out of the jar and crawl all over him. And so how do you use curiosity to work with your anxiety is taking a different tack, which is focusing on the simple things. What color is the butterfly? How fuzzy are its legs? How soft is the texture of its wings? How is this butterfly different than the ones you tend to see in your backyard? And as you're doing this, what is you're changing your relationship to the thing that you fear. You're exploring it. You're investigating it. You're probing it. And our mind can only focus on a few things at one time. And as I'm asking very subtle prompts of what makes this interesting and what does it feel like and how are his legs that are so small able to stick on the side of a wall, the ceiling, and be able to stick there? Is what you find is over the course of the 5, 10, 15 minutes that we're having this conversation that we're exploring is we have now had exposure and a direct clear evidence that you're able to cope with the novelty that's in front of you, having this butterfly present in the room, but you may not even have realized it. Because what happened is we didn't get rid of the anxiety at all. What we did is we changed how you relate to the thing that you're afraid of by trying to purposely explore as opposed to avoid, which is the fundamental conflict when we face things that are a little bit novel, that are a little bit unpredictable. Mm-hmm. And so this is the choices that we have to make. You know, when I walk outside my office and there's an extremely intimidating 6'5", 300-pound muscular person that's walking down the hallway, I can decide not to say hello and try to skitter down the hallway, or I can be sort of a little bit of assertive about it and sort of see what happens if this ends up being a little bit of a shell for this person as opposed to being a really threatening, dangerous person, which is probably unlikely because I'm in the middle of a college campus.
Oh, yeah.
And so these small little choices we make, the individual choices don't matter, but it's the pattern that we make over the course of our life is when we face the new and uncertain, do we choose to avoid and let our anxiety dictate our life, or do you choose to explore and act on our intrigue and curiosity? And over the course of time, it becomes the stamp of our personality.
Wow, that is so interesting. You know, and on a kind of a related note, if you talk about, in the book, you talk about people who, you know, you do this study in the beginning, and it turns out that a lot of people spend their day pretty much just not being very happy because they're not happy with work. And what did you find in that study? And is that, you know, if, I don't know if people are anxious or is it just that they're not really happy with what they're doing? And how can curiosity help them to feel better if they're just like, you know, I've got this 9-to-5 grind and I just live to get home, get out of it?
One of the things is our brains don't care if we have happiness and meaning in our life or love. Our brains don't care. Our brains have been evolutionarily designed to survive and make sure we sleep with as many people as possible to pass on our genes. And so we have this natural battle between biology and the present world that we're faced in. Our brains are not perfectly designed for our current environment.
Yeah,
and so we have to override the machinery. You know, one of the strategies is recognizing that the mind is an entity. And I'm not saying dualism, that the mind is separate from the body. But what I'm saying is recognize our brain for what it is it's constantly charged up thinking about things, and we can listen to it and agree with it, or we can listen to it and disagree with it, just like we're having a conversation with someone at a cocktail party.
Mm.
One of the things about work is our brain likes to make nice habits and routines so it uses as little energy as possible so it can save the reserves for a situation that's quite pressing or potentially dangerous. And so we're very quick to categorize, describe, label things so that no longer grabs our attention. It becomes mundane, it becomes routine, and we have to use less energy. This is really useful because now we have a lot of energy reserves left over if it ends up that we have a serial killer walks into our office in the morning and we can figure out what on our desk could possibly be used as a weapon. Stapler, tape dispenser, coffee cup, all sorts of things. So it's nice that we have a little bit of working memory that's left over that we can make these quick decisions. What becomes problematic is, one, that's an extremely rare occurrence that a serial killer is going to walk into your office. When we quickly categorize and label things, we get bored very quickly.
That's true.
And so one of the strategies for dealing with the boredom, the mundaneness, the horror of Mondays as Sunday starts to creep up on you is start to purposely look for how can we end up generating interest and energy into our routine. And one of the ways of doing that is discovering what are the core values that we have as a person. We spend a lot more time figuring out how am I going to get my heating bill down, what drapes and carpet would be the best fit for the style I'm trying to have for the decor for my living room, than we spend to actually ask questions of what are the fundamental values that are the compass to help me navigate through competing things for what I can do with my time and energy, which is limited.
Yes.
Discovering, you know, is it end up being of, you know, benevolence, making the world a better place? Is it end up being hedonism, is having as much excitement as possible? Does it end up being, you know, for me as a scientist, searching for the truths, a better understanding about humanity and the universe? You know, figuring out your fundamental values, and I have a lot of these exercises in the book.
Oh, yeah.
Once we discover our values, these are these abstract principles. Being a good father, being a responsive, caring spouse, romantic partner. These are not things you can end up ever finishing because they're these abstract things.
Yes.
I can never end being a good father. What I can do is I can start to make concrete goals that link up with those values. So I may say of to being a good father, my goal is to spend a lot of time teaching my kids new things. So that could be one of my goals. Then I can set very specific behaviors on a daily basis, which is I'm going to come home from work at 5 o'clock at least three times this week, no matter what, so I can spend 30 minutes extra with my kid to teach them how to play soccer. I have a very specific behavior linked up to a goal, a concrete goal that's lined up with, converges with, the fundamental values and passions that I have that are really at the center of my personality. And once we do this, and we can map onto very specific behaviors that we're going to make effort towards, our days become a lot more meaningful. Our time becomes a lot more meaningful. We're extracting more pleasure, more energy from our daily lives.
Yeah, I mean, that's so important because it's sad. I mean, really, I mean, when I read that study, there was so many people that pretty much just sort of get through every day just to get to the next day and not really find joy and, you know, intrigue like you're talking about. Now, speaking of joy and intrigue, what is a curious explorer that you talk about in the book?
Right, so this is just another way of thinking about this is a person with a personality trait of being really high in curiosity. You know, this is someone that recognizes and seeks out new knowledge and experiences. This is someone who's highly tolerant of uncertainty. And so what this means is they're comfortable with being in the gray zone, which is I don't know exactly where I stand in my relationship. I don't know exactly what I want to do with my career. And I view this as a challenge, not a threat.
Okay.
And so this is let me give a very concrete example. Playing tennis. If I play Andre Agassi, there's actually no stress involved whatsoever because I know he's going to completely destroy me and obliterate me. If I play my 8-year-old nephew, there's no stress whatsoever because I'm probably going to use my left hand just so he can feel a little bit, you know, develop a little bit of competence.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a good experience. I'm not going to do an overhand serve and try to get a bunch of aces on him on the tennis court. The people that aren't curious explorers like to choose people that are a lot worse or extremely good at things, so they don't have to actually test their abilities or their skills. People that are curious explorers, they like to choose people to be around that are slightly stronger, better, wiser, more intelligent. So they have to stretch their skills, their abilities, just a tiny bit to match onto the conversations, to match onto on the tennis court. They have to run a little bit faster. They have to hit the ball a little bit harder. And inevitably, we grow from these opportunities where we're entering into situations that are a little bit gray, where it's just outside of our abilities and just manageable to handle it. That there's a level of uncertainty there. And curious explorers end up pursuing those experiences. But the thing is, choosing situations, these diagnostic situations of how strong am I really am as a tennis player? How well-versed am I really am in history and having a conversation with someone that's spent their life studying World War II, and I'm a big fan of this. Not being afraid of these situations, but actually looking forward to entering them because I get to learn and grow from these experiences. As we do these, as we seek out these challenging moments over the course of time, we actually start to become a more curious explorer.
Wow. Todd, you have been just so fascinating. I just absolutely loved having you on, and I'd love to have you come back sometime. I want to encourage everyone to get curious. It's such a great book. Todd, how can people find out more about you?
So my website's nice and simple. It's just myname.com. Todd, T-O-D-D, Kashdan, K-A-S-H-D-A-N.
Well, Todd, thank you so much.